From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live.
The country woke up to President-elect Donald Trump today, as well as a Republican-controlled Senate and House. Coming up, we'll talk about the fallout from Election Day, look at how Florida voted, and what those votes mean for state and national politics. Plus, a new generation of veterans are returning from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. This post-9/11 group of veterans are coming back from longer deployments and are fighting what many describe as a different kind of war. We talk with the new generation of veterans about their experiences in the military and how they've adapted to life after serving. But first, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Originally known as Armistice Day, November 11th marks Veterans Day in the United States, a time to honor our country's veterans and the sacrifices they've made in the protection of our country. Veterans Day initially marked the end of World War I, but today we'll put a spotlight on post-9/11 veterans. Later this hour, the challenges that can come with transitioning back into civilian life and local nonprofit efforts aimed at helping the latest generation of vets returning from more than a decade and a half of war. But first, Donald Trump crossed the 270 electoral vote threshold at about 2:30 this morning to become the 45th president of the United States. Florida's coveted 29 electoral votes went to Trump in an election with a record turnout of more than 9.5 million voters in the Sunshine State. Trump defeated Hillary Clinton in Florida by a margin of about 100,000 votes. That's a wider margin than by which President Obama took Florida when he carried the state 4 years ago. This election was also the first to take place under new congressional and state legislative district boundaries, following the passage of the Fair District Amendments 6 years ago aimed at addressing gerrymandered districts. Floridians also voted down the utility-backed Solar Initiative Amendment 1 and voted in favor of a constitutional amendment expanding legalized medical marijuana by more than a 70% margin. Joining me now for a closer look at the election, how Floridians voted, and what the results will mean going forward is University of South Florida political scientist Dr. Susan McManus. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you for having me.
And with us in studio today is Florida Gulf Coast University political science professors Dr. Roger Green and Dr. Peter Bergerson. Always good to have you with us.
Well, thanks. Thanks
nice
to be
here.
Also in studio is political reporter Jenna Pazuko-Forrester with Florida Politics, which covers campaigns, elections, government, policy, and lobbying in Florida. You can find them at floridapolitics.com. Jenna, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And we're joined by President of the Collier County Chapter of the NAACP, Harold Weeks. Welcome back to the program.
I pinch myself and I'm still here, business as usual. Good afternoon, Susan.
Hi.
And I invite listeners to join our conversation as well. Share your thoughts on the results of the November election with us and ask your questions. Phone lines are open at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. Or tweet us. We're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And Susan McManus, Roger Green, and Peter Bergerson, I wanted to start with you as the political science heavyweights in the room. Were you surprised by President-elect Donald Trump's victory? Brent Batten with the Naples Daily News wrote a piece just before the election with the headline, "Whoever wins the presidential election, the experts are losers."
I was not surprised, frankly. It's a 1% election again. Florida, three elections in a row is been decided by 1%, and the distance between registered Democrats and Republicans in the state had narrowed to only 2.5%. And so I had projected a 1% win, just thought it might be in the other direction. There was way too much hype of the Latino influence on the early election vote. It could not offset the drop in turnout and performance for Hillary Clinton, among other key bases, which would include millennials, women, and also the black voters in Florida.
I would agree that I think pretty hits it right on the button. A turnout election and Trump got his base out and Hillary did not. The surprising factor was that Trump did not have the organization to get the out vote like Hillary did, and that was surprising.
Yeah, I wasn't.
But he did have the organization. It was just that it wasn't what people normally thought of. All the hype was about 51 headquarters that she opened up around the state. Meanwhile, the Republican Party deferred to the oldest of old models, letting local party county committees register people and turn them out. And that's how he stayed even all the way. And that was a totally ignored factor. All people were looking at is she created all these new offices, often staff of people from out of the state or out of the area. And the Republicans relied upon neighbor to neighbor in neighborhoods where people knew each other. So, you know, the idea that there wasn't a turnout mechanism among Republicans is just really, I think, an antiquated description of how this turned out.
Dr. Green?
Yeah, I thought it was going to be exceptionally close, but I did not think that Trump could succeed in the whole series of crucial swing states where he eked out these 1% victories in places like Florida, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. I mean, there was a whole series of states where it was almost like every single case where it was exceptionally close and the outcome would have a crucial impact on the race, he nailed those. And that I did not think could happen.
And this is, the second time in recent elections past that the candidate who has won the popular vote, in fact, did not win the Electoral College vote. What kind of an impact do you think that's going to have going forward?
Well, I think it's going to certainly increase some calls on behalf of the, what's known as the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which would be designed to, since it would be unlikely or impossible to ever secure a constitutional amendment that would eliminate the Electoral College, it's sort of a workaround that would be designed to ensure that the winner of the popular vote is the winner of the presidential election. So I think there will be increased calls for that, but I don't know that I don't know that that will secure buy-in from the red states that would be needed for it to happen, because after all, this has benefited them to have this current arrangement.
All right. Well, let's hear a clip now from President-elect Trump's acceptance speech.
Now it's time for America to bind the wounds of division. We have to get together. To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people. It's time. I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans, and this is so important to me. For those who have chosen not to support me in the past, of which there were a few people, I'm reaching out to you for your guidance and your help so that we can work together and unify our great country. As I've said from the beginning, ours was not a campaign, but rather an incredible and great movement made up of millions of hardworking men and women who love their country, Americans from all races, religions, backgrounds, and beliefs, who want and expect our government to serve the people, and serve the people it will.
And Susan McManus, given how Trump's rhetoric on the campaign trail in this campaign had so often broken from convention, were you surprised by the tone and tenor of Trump's words in this acceptance speech? Do you think it could be a sign that a Trump presidency could perhaps be quite different from a Trump campaign?
I would have actually been shocked if it had not been as conciliatory, because the first thing that any president that's won with the kind of election that we just had has to do is to try to unite the country again. I was actually very impressed with both the acceptance speech and Hillary Clinton's concession speech this morning, and both of them have stressed the oldest dimension of democracy, and that's the peaceful transition of power in the United States of America. It's a signal to the rest of the world about what sets us apart, and each of them stress that in their speeches, and the need to work together to bridge the biggest divide that we've seen in this country in years.
All right. And Harold Weeks, I wanted to get your reaction to Trump's victory and how you think it'll resonate with, Southwest Florida's African-American community and African-American communities throughout the U.S. more broadly.
Let me say this to you. I'm not a professional, and I'm just one black man here in America, so I can't speak for all of them. I can only give you my thoughts on the subject. I was talking to a young man this morning while I walked, and I said, listen, we're both black men. I said, we've had our trials and tribulations, and we always will. Things don't necessarily change for us. At least this time, you have a president, no one will be shouting at him that you're a liar, saying disparaging things, or saying that we're never going to work with you. We're going to do everything to not help you or help your views or things that you want to do go forward. With that said, I'm not surprised by the election. I said before that Trump is a very good spin merchant, and he does his job well. At the beginning, he was just saying things that people thought, and then he finally got people saying things about what they thought out loud, and we've had a division in this country for quite some time. They thought it would come together with President Obama. All it did was divide us even furtherly. And with Trump in there, we won't disparage. Like I say, I've been disappointed before, so disappointed is a part of life for me. But it doesn't mean I quit. And hopefully others out there, black, white, or brown, or whatever color you are, won't quit. And this is still the greatest country on earth. It was great before someone decided that it wasn't great. And it will be great again. If this is a disappointment to people, if this is a mistake, we've lived through it before, we'll live through it again. I've spoken to people overseas and in Europe, places like Germany and Belgium and Denmark. And I know some of you are, as first generation Americans, have talked to your relatives over there, and they're firmly disappointed. And they're saying, ooh, what's going to happen to America now? That's been said before, it'll be said again. But let me say this, and I'll say it again. In black America, we will survive. We've survived every other thing, and we'll survive Trump and what he has to say. So I say, bring it on. We'll deal with it. We'll get through with it. And we'll be so-called great again.
And Dr. Bergerson, I see you've got some voting statistics in front of you. Can you maybe give us a little bit of a breakdown or an idea, among who Trump supporters were, demographically speaking, versus candidate Clinton's?
Yeah, well, one of the things was that the turnout between 12 and 16, there are some noticeable differences, and particularly, for instance, on the gender issue, why a few more men voted, at least 1% more than they did 4 years ago, but slightly fewer women voted. But the difference is that significantly more men voted for Trump this time than they did 4 years ago. And also the number who had voted for women this time was slightly down compared to what 4 years ago. And so that was a difference. The millennial vote, those between 18 and 29, it went up slightly one percentage, but to 19% of the total vote. But again, 4 years ago, 66% of the millennials voted for President Obama. This time, only 55% voted for Hillary. And so that was an interesting statistic. The white vote 4 years ago amounted for 74% of the voting population. This time, 70%. But President-elect Trump got 56% of that. One of the important numbers, I think, was the African-American vote. And perhaps this isn't a fair standard, but 4 years ago, the African-American vote accounted for 13% of the total vote, but 95% of the African-American vote voted for President Obama. This year was 12%, and only 88% voted for Hillary Clinton. So you can see these were some of the places where the difference was. And if you look at some of the other statistics, like income, education, for instance, 4 years ago in the education, high school education or less was about 24% of the total vote. This time, it was less, but overwhelming support for President-elect Trump. And so those are some of the things that at least stood out to me in a rather quick look at it. One of the things I think that really important was that the independent, those who identified themselves in exit polling as independents, 29% saw themselves as independents, and President Obama got 52% of them. This time, 31% considered themselves independents, and President-elect Trump got 48%. And so you can see that, A, the independents are growing a little bit, and also that they really made a significant difference. Also, those who considered themselves Democrats, they were down a little bit from 39 to 37%, and the Republicans were slightly up, and their vote was approximately the same. So those are some of the things that I saw off the bat. There's others, but those stood out.
And you know, just when it comes to reactions, not just from within the country, but internationally, I wanted to get thoughts from our guest today. For instance, global markets reacted. Japan's Nikkei plunged 5.4%. Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index lost 3.2%. Futures on the Standard & Poor's 500 Index hit a trading halt designed to limit losses, and the Dow was down about just less than 3.5% in futures trading. Is that something that is going to potentially be long-term, or do you think these are just short-term reactions?
My guess is they're going to be short-term. It depends on what you mean by short-term. You know, every day is a new dawn in the stock market. But, yeah, I think that this is a reaction, frankly, less than what I thought that it might have been. I think that the futures market last night or early this morning was an indication that there may be a huge jumping off the cliff, and that has not been the case.
And what about when it comes to international reaction from world leaders? We know Russian President Vladimir Putin congratulated Trump, expressing hope that relationships between the U.S. and Russia would improve, quote, from their crisis state, end quote. But what about reactions from other world leaders? How have they ranged? Susan McManus?
I don't know so much about that, but I have dealt massively with the international news media from across the world, and there's just a stunned disbelief that the race turned out like this, and a little anxiety about what it means for foreign policy in the country. That's not surprising whatsoever. But they were just absolutely convinced that America was turning bluer, and the thing that everybody misses, I think we haven't talked enough about, is the fact that the huge turnout in the suburban counties, in the metropolitan areas, and the always high turnout in the rural parts of Florida and across the country were where the uprising came from. And those places are home to people who've lost jobs, the middle to lower middle income people, often with kids. And internationally, people tend to look at big cities, and they don't really understand the rural, urban, and suburban dimensions of America.
Yeah, Florida Governor and U.S. Senator Bob Graham reacted to news of Trump's victory, saying that it must stem from a deep anger or discontent among, you know, many American people that most politicians didn't fully recognize. Do you think that's a pretty fair assessment?
I absolutely do. But you could see it in several of the measures that I always start presentations with. And that first one is the trend in the people being asked whether the country's headed in the right direction or wrong direction. And for two-thirds of Americans, it's been wrong direction for over a decade. So that's the context into which this particular election plopped. And it, albeit the different reasons why people think the country's headed in the right or wrong direction. The economy, you've seen it in Florida, you saw it in all these other states. Economic anxiety among the middle to lower income individuals whose jobs have been left the country, who haven't really recovered from the Great Recession. They're still underemployed or part-time employed or not employed at all. And you also have security anxieties. When you look at the two issues in Florida that mattered most to people, it was the economy and terrorism, which you can expand to include personal security, fears of these random shootings and whatever. This was an unsettled country. And it really boiled down to, do you want change or do you not? And the dichotomy couldn't have been clearer. And people who feel left behind or threatened or fearful for their security said they wanted change, pure and simple.
And John, if I might just add one thing here, since we talked about sort of the international response, I think it's also important to look at this election, presidential election outcome in relation to some similar trends in European countries. There's been a resurgence of right-wing extremism in Europe, in part in response to concerns or discontents over globalization and immigration. The surprising outcome of the Brexit vote, mm-hmm. which is another case where the prognosticators kind of had it wrong and everybody was shocked. But all of these, I think it's really important to see that this is not just something isolated to the United States. It's something that is much more geographically significant.
All right. And just one more question on the international front there. Is it difficult in general to kind of speculate on what Trump's, policy priorities and goals are going to be as president? And just as an example, on his plan to defeat ISIS, at one point he'd said he wouldn't talk about it publicly because he didn't want to tip off the enemy. Then at another time he'd say he'd give his generals 30 days to come up with a plan. So kind of saying, I have a plan, but I'm not going to tell you. No, I don't actually have a plan. We're going to come up with one later. Does it kind of make it difficult, besides just foreign policy, to really know what we might be looking at?
Well, I think that, look, we don't know what's going to happen, but my prediction would be that when Donald Trump actually has to start dealing with the reality of being a president and he has to interact with the defense and intelligence establishment – with what will be, I think, a kind of clear signal from them, which presidents always have to deal with, that you can expect some pushback. You know, you don't just come in and start kind of throwing your weight around. I don't know that I anticipate that it will be quite as extreme as his bombastic rhetoric during the campaign would have suggested. I think I'd probably anticipate more significant developments or changes with respect to things like international environmental policies and accords, those sorts of things. But defense and dealing with intelligence matters, that may not change as much as we might have imagined based on his rhetoric.
And I think you also have to keep in mind that, at least in the dealing with the Middle East, we have other countries engaged there, and so we have partners or working with or somehow relationships that we have to coordinate our policy, or he has to coordinate his policy with what they're doing.
Right. And so it's not just going to be unilateral.
And that's going to present some issues to iron out in a 30-day period of time.
And Jenna Bazzuco-Forrester with Florida Politics, you know, you've written about many of Florida's congressional district races. Any surprises or upsets, with the results you've looked at?
You know, I think a few of the districts that people were really watching, one was over in Miami, Joe Garcia versus Representative Carlos Carballo. That was a rematch from just 2 years ago. And Representative Carballo was able to keep that seat despite the redistricting. And I think it was even a little bit more favorable to Democrats. You know, over here in Southwest Florida, Ambassador Rooney, Francis Rooney, congressman-elect now, he pretty much crushed his competition, and he largely self-financed, and he had the ability to. But on the other coast, there was a similar race. It pit Brian Mast, a combat veteran on the Treasure Coast, against Randy Perkins, another person who was able to self-finance. But that race that was to replace Representative Patrick Murphy. And that flipped the district to red, and Brian Mast, who had a lot of outside help from outside organizations and super PACs, he was able to come out on top despite Randy Perkins putting something like $7 million of his own money into that race.
And speaking of Representative Murphy, he lost his bid for the Senate to incumbent Marco Rubio. Any surprises there, given that, you know, Marco Rubio earlier had his eyes on the presidency and had said he wasn't even going to seek the office initially for re-election?
We looked back at polls since June, and he led in every poll but three, and in three polls he tied. And Marco Rubio just has so much name recognition. He's served here for 6 years. He was on the national stage before he was even a presidential candidate. Patrick Murphy came in to the very end. He still had very low name recognition. The Democratic groups that were supporting him pulled out money. He wasn't on air as much. And I think it was just a matter of people know Marco Rubio. What's going to be interesting now is he said he will serve 6 years. Is that going to actually happen?
Right. And, you know, other big news here in Florida, we had the solar-related ballot initiative. That did go down in defeat.
Yeah.
And this comes on the heels of a ballot initiative that voters did approve in August. Tell us just a little bit about that and you know, especially regarding the anti-solar folks and you know, how they were able to squeak out their own victory with the defeat of amendment, the solar-powered amendment.
Yeah, that solar power amendment that that was just on the ballot, it had the backing of pretty much every major utility, and it was being pushed as good for solar. There was an active but small campaign to sort of defeat it, to go against it. It needed 60% of the vote. I think it received 51-ish percent. You know, it was being billed as deceptive, that it would really not offer options to people seeking solar. And so I think that the opposition, while somewhat small and quieter compared to other amendments like Amendment 2, they were able to get that message out. And Amendment 1 backers had some bad luck. There was some pretty negative press in recent weeks about these so-called deceptive techniques with their amendment.
Right, the political jujitsu comment.
Yeah. And that's never something you want to hear 2 weeks before the election and as people are starting to cast ballots.
Right. And, you know, following the defeat of Amendment 2, you know, expanding medical marijuana in Florida, you know, we'd seen medical marijuana amendments go down in defeat in the past. This time it did pass. What changed, do you think?
They changed the ballot language, put in some more specific conditions, and it didn't have as much pushback from the state leaders. Pam Bondi just sort of let it go through, the attorney general. And it was a huge turnout year. And the amendment received broad support of 70% and across all demographics, all age groups for months now. They had a really good get-out-the-vote technique, and they were really helped by this record turnout we saw. Opposition campaigns, though, they put millions of dollars into it, and they fell flat. They couldn't get it to happen this year.
And this election did mark the first in Florida to occur under revamped congressional and legislative district boundaries following the passage of the, you know, Fair District Amendment Initiative 6 years ago. Did it have much of an impact in terms of you know, the outcome or the balance of power, you know, among Florida's congressional delegation or the makeup of the state legislature.
So when you look at the state legislature, there were some seats in the Senate, which is where the redistricting happened, that they could have picked up. But the Senate Democrats couldn't seem to get that ball across the field. They lost a seat in Senate District 40, and they were able to pick up one in Miami-Dade County with the senator elect now, Jose Javier Rodriguez. But they couldn't get a couple of other Miami-Dade seats to switch. And in the Tampa Bay area, Dana Young, who is well-liked and was the majority leader in the House, she was able to top a Democratic opponent and a really well-known no-party affiliate opponent.
All right. And I wanted to address early voting as well. You know, the AP reports that about half of Florida's nearly 13 million registered voters had taken advantage of early voting before it ended Sunday. How have we seen the utilization of early voting evolve since it was first introduced in Florida in 2005? Susan?
Well, the thing about early voting, there was never a very good comparison between this year and 2012 for three reasons. First of all, both parties and both candidates aggressively and for months on end urged voters to vote early. You did not have that impetus in 2012. Secondly, you saw the supervisors of elections in all 67 counties doing the same. Please vote early. You know, we didn't have that in 2012. And thirdly, the oversaturation of TV ads and mailers and robocalls and whatever else really prompted a lot of people to vote early just so they could come to closure, you know, listen to no more ads, read nothing else. They were done with the election. Psychologically, it was stressful. So I think that all the early hype about how different the early voting was going to make things turn out was really, and by comparison to comparing to earlier numbers, really gave a false impression about what the vote would actually turn out to look like.
All right. And Jenna, just a final issue as we wrap up today's segment. Tell us about the GMO mosquitoes ballot initiative that Florida Keys residents voted on.
Yeah, there was a ballot initiative. It is a non-binding referendum, but several members of the Mosquito Control Board down there said they would support it, which would allow a British company called Oxitec to release genetically modified mosquitoes in a very small part of the community, Key Haven. So they put two ballot referendums on. In Key Haven, where the testing was actually set to occur, it went down, but they put a larger countywide referendum on where it passed. The test would essentially allow the company to release genetically modified male mosquitoes, which are the kind that don't bite. They're not the ones that are going to harass you. And it reduces the population. They've seen pretty big, great results in Panama, in Brazil, in urban areas, of reducing the population and then dropping the amount of mosquito-borne diseases. It's going to be interesting to see whether they move forward. Like I said, the testing was expected to occur in Key Haven, and they've been talking about it for years now. And that's where the ballot measure failed, but they put it on for the whole county, and now it'll be interesting to see if they move it to another area where it might be a little bit more favorable.
All right. We'll be watching that as well then. That is all the time we have for this portion of the program, though. But thanks so much to my guests. We've been speaking with Dr. Roger Green and Dr. Peter Bergerson, both political science professors here at Florida Gulf Coast University. Always great to have you with us.
Nice to be here, John.
Dr. Great. Susan McManus is a political scientist with the University of South Florida in Tampa. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Harold Weeks is president of the NAACP's Collier County chapter. Appreciate you joining us as well.
My pleasure.
And Jenna Bazzucco-Forrester is a political reporter with Florida Politics. You can read her coverage online at floridapolitics.com. We're taking a short break, but when we return, November 11th marks Veterans Day. We put a spotlight on the latest generation of post-9/11 vets, their experiences and challenges reintegrating into civilian life, and local efforts to assist them. That conversation's just ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live on WGCU-FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.